Today at 1 on Hometown Heroes, a glimpse back into Fresno's World War II history. What kind of planes were loading the runways here, and where did Hammer Field get that moniker?
Earl Hammer.
That's
who the field's named for.
Okay, so who was Earl Hammer? This World War II veteran has the answer in his new book, and we'll hear all about it this afternoon at 1 on News Talk 580 and FM 105.9, brought to you by Humana, proud to honor our hometown heroes.
As Americans, we enjoy many freedoms. Among them are the freedom to vote, to worship, and to speak our mind. These freedoms have long been protected by the men and women of our armed forces and their families that supported them. For more than 15 years, Humana has made a commitment to our veteran community. That commitment continues today with the introduction of the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans and their families. In developing this product, we listened to more than 10,000 veterans. With their input and our 50 years of expertise in the healthcare industry, we developed an affordable dental plan that also includes discounts on vision, hearing, retail prescription drugs, and more. We are proud to offer this plan to our veterans and their families right here in Fresno and throughout the country. We are also proud to announce that Humana is now the 2012 exclusive healthcare partner for the MVETS. Find out more about the Humana Preventive Plus package for veterans. Call our Fresno office, 559-221-2522, 559-221-2522.
News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. If you missed last week's program with 88-year-old George Gruner, you can listen to it online just like all the rest of the shows at kmjnow.com. Mr. Gruner allowed us to do what we do pretty much every Saturday, hop along for the ride as a World War II veteran remembers his experiences in the service way back when. We call it Hometown Heroes because no matter where your hometown might be, anywhere in this wonderful country of ours, there are people right there in your hometown, maybe even right next door to you, who have done a lot more than we realize for the sake of our freedom. Today, you'll hear the same voice you heard last week, just a different kind of story. The story of a city and its contribution to the war effort 70 years ago. The city is Fresno. And if you want to get the whole story, you'll want to read George Gruner's great hardbound book, Into the Night, Hammerfield, Camp Pinedale, Fresno Fairgrounds, Central California in World War II. Head out to Chandler Airport next Saturday from 9:30 to 2, and you can have Mr. Gruner sign it for you. I was at the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno this week, and I ran into a listener who was there just to pick up this book. The proceeds go to that museum, as well as the Clovis Veterans Memorial District. We'll get into the book, but let's pick up kind of where we left off last week. I want to find out how Mr. Gruner came to Central California. We heard about your adventures with the 440th Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion during World War II, including the Battle of the Bulge. But when the war was over, you were, I think, ready to rekindle your journalism career, and that career almost took a different path.
Just about the time I got orders to come to the States, I got an offer to join Stars and Stripes. And I thought, I'm going to go home. Because I knew I had a job at the Oakland Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
So I came home, and I didn't get to Stripes until 1952.
You survived not only the close calls that you talked about, where moments where you thought you were going to be killed, but also these twists of fate where someone else was sent that could have been you.
Yeah.
So when you come home, still a very young man, I mean, you're what, 20 years old when you got home?
Yeah, I got out of the Army. I think 11 days before my 21st birthday, and then I was eligible to vote.
And you had experienced all of this, and you had come as close as you wanted to having your life come to an end. Did all of that give you a different perspective when you were back in this country with the war over?
Well, I suppose I think it probably matured me a lot faster than I would have at home. When you're working in a newspaper, particularly up in the Bay Area where it wasn't quite like it is now, but there were still lots of incidents that you go out on crimes and stuff like that. I remember I went back to the paper and I resumed being a reporter, and we'd go out on shootings and things like that. I remember one instance when I was left alone in a room after the police had decided that the fella had shot in the head and that he was dead and he was lying there on the floor, when I heard a voice ask me, say, "Hey, you got a cigarette?" And I looked around. There's nobody else in the room but me and the corpse. And I looked at him, and he's moving a little with it, and I yelled back into the cops and said, "Hey, come back. This corpse is alive." I followed him to the hospital, the county hospital, and he had his cigarette by then. But in the newspaper business, you're exposed to the seamier side of life.
Sure.
A lot. So I had some exposure to that. But I'm sure that my lifelong belief in being a fatalist stemmed from the war. And I think it was a good experience. I still say this, that my military time was good for me, both in the States and overseas. And I believe that universal service would be good for our young people today.
Mm-hmm.
I really do.
Well, and I know that when you got to the Fresno Bee, a lot of the people working for you had been in the war, too, just like you were. And heard some of them on this program, guys like Eli Settinson, Vern Cole. And I'm sure there are more that I'm not thinking of right now.
Sure.
How did you end up at the Fresno Bee, where you would spend the bulk of your journalism
career?
Well,
as I said, I met my wife at the Oakland Tribune, and she was a Fresno area girl. She grew up in Sanger. She had gone to UC during the war and got a teaching degree. She taught in Richmond schools during the war. And then she had an interest in journalism, so she got a job at the Oakland Tribune. So I met her there. After we were married, we decided to take off and travel in Europe. And so we went to Europe in 1952. And she became pregnant, and our son was born in Germany, actually. Mm. But it was either come home or settle down over there. So I went to Stars and Stripes and walked in the door at the right time there. They had an opening, and I got hired as a civilian. It was a civilian staff in those days. Still is, I guess. And we had a desk operation there. Most of the field guys were GIs and so on, but the newsroom operation was basically a copy desk operation. So I learned to be a copy editor. I've been a reporter at the Oakland Tribune, but I learned to be a copy editor at Stripes. I had a 2-year contract there. And when the contract was up, well, we came back to the States, and I was looking for a job in San Diego because they had a pipeline from the Stripes to the San Diego papers. But it turned out that they folded one of the San Diego papers just about that time. The Tribune, the San Diego Tribune, folded and became a part of the Union Tribune.
Right, yep.
So I was looking for a job. I could have gone back to Oakland, but didn't want to do that. And we were operating out of my wife's folks' ranch out near Sanger, and she says, "Well, why don't you go down to the Fresno Bee?" So I thought, well, okay. So now Fresno, you remember, for a Bay Area guy, Fresno was a place you went through as fast as the speed limit would let you, particularly in the summertime. But anyway, I
went down. Spoken like a reformed Bay Area snob there.
Yeah, a reformed Bay Area snob, right. So anyway, I went down to the Bee. Here again, fate played a role. They had an opening on the copy desk just at that moment. Mm-hmm. And so I walked in. I got a job on the copy desk as a rim rat, as we called ourselves. Spent quite a bit of time there and then moved over to the city desk, assistant city editor, because of my writing background, assistant city editor, and assistant managing editor, executive editor. Stayed there for 33 years. The McClatchy people were great people to work for. They had a reputation as a newsman's newspaper staff, and they had the three B's at that time.
Right.
Eleanor McClatchy was the boss lady, and she took care of her people, and I'll always be grateful to the time I spent at the B.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think the readers are grateful for it, too. And I want to talk to you about your latest writing project, because there's a couple great causes that benefit from it. Besides just the education you can get, a little history here in the Valley that I think most people are unaware of. But before I get to that, wrapping up your newspaper career, and it's hard to stick 33 years into a couple minutes, but one of the things that you became most famous for in your time at the Bee was when you decided that it was important enough to you to stand on principle that you spent some time in jail. Can you give us the nutshell sketch of that?
Well, what was involved there was a grand jury report about a council discussion involving an effort to turn the garbage franchise. Where have you heard that before? Garbage franchise.
Everything comes back around,
yeah,
doesn't it?
Right, doesn't it? A Los Angeles outfit wanted to take over the garbage franchise in Fresno, and a city councilman testified to the fact that he had been hired. He was an attorney. He had been hired by this Los Angeles outfit and had received a retainer from them, and that he would receive an additional amount if the vote was successful in the council. That fact had never come out in public, and we came into possession of the information in the transcript that presented in his own words this statement. And we held it for a couple of weeks while we considered it. And I was the editor at the time. And every time we got involved in any kind of a public issue, my concern was always, what is the public interest in this? Mm-hmm. What do we publish about this incident, whether it involve a minister who was having difficulty with his flock or other items. And I would weigh heavily, what is the public interest? In this case, the vote was scheduled, and the fact that he was in the pay of the proponents had not come out, so we went with the story. Judge Peckinpah was the judge in charge of the grand jury at the time, and he wanted to know where we got the information, because grand jury testimony is secret until it's generally released by
right.
the jury. So he wanted to know where we got it, what was the source. And we, at the time, were operating under the California Shield Law, which says newsmen do not have to reveal mm-hmm. a confidential source. So politely declined to tell him. Well, two reporters involved, Bill Patterson and Joe Rosato. Joe Rosato is still in Fresno. Mm-hmm. Bill Patterson now lives in Utah. They first declined to testify. Then Jim Bort, who has passed away now, the city editor, declined instructions from the judge to tell him because they assumed that he knew. And then ultimately they got me involved because I was the boss of all of them, and I could tell them, direct them to tell the judge what he wanted to know. Mm-hmm. And I politely declined under the same findings. The judge said, well, the legislature passed the law, had no jurisdiction over the judicial branch, and therefore the law did not apply, and that, by golly, tell them or we're going to send you to jail. Well, we still declined to tell him, so he sent us to jail under the coercion rule, said, well, I'm going to hold you till you talk. By that time, we'd gone through 2 years of appeals to I think we went to the state Supreme Court twice, to the U.S. Supreme Court twice. We had lawyers in San Francisco, Sacramento, Fresno, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C., all paid for by the McClatchy Company.
Right.
Who C.K. McClatchy, then the editor, came to me and said, and to the others, and said, look, we can pay all the bills, but we can't go to jail for you. If it's up to you guys.
Right.
What do you want to do? What do you think is proper? And we all said, well, we'd all be destroyed in the profession if we reveal the source.
Yeah.
And also, we would never be able to get a confidential source again mm-hmm. if we rolled over.
Yep.
So we stuck to our guns and went to jail.
For how long?
15 days. And then our attorneys, a local attorney, the lead attorney was Phil Fullerton, says that when you're under a coercive sentence, if you can convince the judge that the coercion will not work, then he must set you free. So we gathered experts from Washington, from the writers from back there, who testified as to the basic tenet of the profession. And we had a local psychiatrist that say that we were strengthened in our resolve. And by that time, Judge Holly Best was handling the case. He turned us loose with credit for time served as mm-hmm. punishment for the thing. But we never revealed the source. To this day, the source has never been revealed. And we felt that we had served not only our profession, but also the community by revealing the fact. And as a matter of fact, as a result of that way, the whole issue went away mm-hmm. until now.
That is something to be very proud of. And I know that people across the country certainly were behind you in that. And I'm sure have congratulated you yeah. and thanked you in all the years yeah. since then.
We were known as the B4 mm-hmm. or the Fresno 4 in other right. cities. But we have had that on our resumes ever since.
You jailbird, you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's one you can actually be proud of. And now what you're proud of, and you should be, is this great new book, Into the Night, which I mentioned, we hear veterans' individual histories, but this really is the history of Fresno during World War II and the installations that were here, the kinds of things that went on there. When you tell people about the book, why don't you share that with our audience? How do you describe what you've done here in this project?
Well, what I did is that since my retirement from the Bee in 88, I've written three books. Both of them, prior books, had some military aspects to them. One was The Battleship California. But basically, in discussions with other local historians, I would say, you know, somebody ought to someday write a book about Hammer Field, because so many people, you go around and talk to them and say, you ever heard of Hammer Field? Never heard of it. If you say, well, if I told you it was the Fresno Air Terminal or Yosemite International, would you recognize, oh, is that Hammer Field? Yeah, it is. And that's how it came to be. It started out that as a military base built before Pearl Harbor, actually, early 1941. So anyway, as I said, somebody ought to write that book. And somebody pointed at me and said, why don't you write it? I couldn't think of a good excuse, and I had nothing to do. And I enjoy histories. I enjoy research. So I decided to get into it in depth. And I put in 4 years of research on Hammer Field. Come to find out also that you can't talk about Hammer Field without talking about the two other bases that were here. All of them were basically Army Air Corps installations. Remember, that was the forerunner of the Air Force. It was Army Air Corps in those days. Some people think that Camp Pinedale was built before Hammer Field, but that's not the truth. Hammer Field got started on St. Patrick's Day of 1941, after the Army Air Corps had sent people in this area looking for a place to build a Central California bomber base.
Okay, I'm going to stop you there for now. It's break time. We'll get more about the origins of Hammer Field and even how it acquired that name. For the whole story, pick up the book Into the Night by our guest today, George Gruner. That way you can find out why Marlena Dietrich's picture is in it. And again, if you want to have it signed by the author, next Saturday, 9:30 to 2 p.m. at Chandler Airport in Fresno. There's something else happening at Chandler before that I want to tell you about, too. And I'll do that when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Las Banas at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Las Banas every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common: Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Las Banas.
on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, talking to 88-year-old George Gruner. Last week, we got the story of his service in World War II. This week, we're talking about his book, Into the Night, which chronicles the origins and exploits of three military installations in the Fresno area during World War II. Mr. Gruner will be signing copies of the book next Saturday, May the 4th, from 9:30 to 2 at Chandler Airport in Fresno. Before that, there's another event at Chandler that I think if you like this program, you'll probably enjoy this too. Basically, all day this coming Wednesday, May the 1st, from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on May the 1st, you can catch a 1942 Stearman biplane taking veteran after veteran up for joyrides. It's part of a really neat program called Ageless Aviation Dreams. It's coming Wednesday, May 4th from 10 to 5 at Chandler Airport. It's not going to cost you anything just to go and watch, and it's really neat what they do. I want to tip my cap to Willowood USA and Joe Midione for making it possible, sponsoring this tour of the Stearman. If you're listening in Porterville, this plane is going to be in your hometown on Monday. They'll have some special flights for veterans in Corcoran on Tuesday, and then on Wednesday, Fresno is the seventh and final stop on the Central California Dream Flight Tour. So that's Dream Flight, not to be confused with Honor Flight. Boy, am I excited about Honor Flight. You're going to hear a whole lot more about that in the weeks to come. But let's hear more now about Fresno during World War II, or maybe even before, I guess. Mr. Gruner, take it away.
At that time, I'm talking about 1940, why Roosevelt had pushed through Congress big grants of money to build a 10,000-plane Air Force. Mm-hmm. And they had to have the fields for all of those bases. So almost every little flying field around here got involved either as a primary training base. Eagle Field is a remnant of what those were. And, of course, Merced and
Lemoore.
Lemoore was Visalia. An Army base.
Yeah.
And Visalia and Bakersfield. All of those ultimately became sub-bases of Hammer Field. Anyway, I got started on it, put in about 4 years of research. The book deals with the early days of Hammer as a training base for mid-sized bombers, mostly twin-engine bombers, the B-25s and the 26s, the Mitchells and the Marauders and so mm-hmm. on. In the middle years, it became a base where they brought in the B-24s. And the most significant unit that served here was the 461st Bomb Group, which came down from Utah, came to Hammerfield, trained here for about 60 days, which was basically the training time for a bomber group. And during that time, that's when we had what I refer to in the book as the bombers in the lakes. We have two lakes up there that have units, planes from the 461st mm-hmm. that took off on training missions, which usually involve flights to down into Arizona, down as far as Yuma sometimes, and also down to what in the old days was called Muroc
right.
Air Base,
yeah.
which is Edwards now. Mm-hmm. And I even had an experience with Muroc. I had a battleship there was a battleship at Muroc.
How'd that happen?
Well, when I'm training out there with my first outfit, the 817th, we were on a maneuver somewhere, and we went over towards Muroc. We looked out across the dry lakes, you know, and we could see a battleship out there, the silhouette of a full-size battleship.
In the middle of the desert.
In the middle of the desert. And we're all thinking we're hallucinating. But finally, when the heat waves cleared, we discovered that there really was a silhouette of a battleship out there built of lath, wooden lath. And they used it as a bombing target in early training. And the story was they'd fly over with flour sacks
yep.
and drop flour on it. And that thing was out there at least through the war. Getting back to Hammer Field, planes would fly down into that area. These two bombers, one of them flew out of Hammer on a southern trip down to Arizona and never came back. They sent out the rest of the 461st, all the other planes of the various squadrons, up the next day to hunt for this first plane. One of those planes involved is the plane which is now in Huntington Lake.
Mm-hmm.
It developed engine trouble on the way down, and the commander of the plane authorized the crew to bail out, but they were pretty low, so they could take their choice, whether to ride the plane down. They knew they were over Huntington Lake, even though it was not all frozen, but some frozen. Two guys who bailed out survived.
Right.
One of them is still alive, and I understand there's going to be he's not able to travel anymore, but I understand there's going to be some kind of an observance at Huntington Lake towards the end of May.
Hmm.
It's the 70th anniversary of those two planes that went into the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a little museum up there, you know.
Right.
And
yeah.
Those folks are going to have some kind of an observance in the latter part of May.
And there have been multiple efforts to try to dredge up all those pieces of that
plane. Well,
there were.
You're partly right. There were multiple efforts to identify where it was. There were two efforts, I think, to dredge up the pieces. The first one was undertaken by the Navy after the war, and they've pinpointed it. But actually, the way they pinpointed it was they lowered the lake.
Mm-hmm.
The lake, the Edison Company, had to do some repairs very low on the dams. So they had to take the lake much below its normal drop.
Mm-hmm.
And when they lowered the lake, why, here out of the depths rose the parts of the second bomber.
Right.
And when it came time to refill the lake, why, they took the bodies out.
Right.
The bodies were pretty well preserved. And they are now in various locations.
It's my understanding. I was just at Castle Air Museum a couple weeks ago, but the B-24 that they have at Castle Air Museum is an amalgam of a bunch of different B-24s.
Yeah.
And part of the nose of that B-24 at Castle was recovered from Huntington Lake. They have a piece on the nose of that B-24 at Castle.
Interesting because in the dredging, the second time they had to do some repairs on the dam, a local group decided to take some parts out of the lake and set up a museum.
Yeah.
And they got them on a barge up there, the engine and a piece of the wing.
I remember that.
And the group ran out of money.
Yeah.
And the guys that owned the dredging equipment and the barge took it away to Rio Vista up in the Delta.
Yeah.
And that's where I lost track of it. But it would be a good case for a local group to take up the search.
Get the rest of it.
Get the rest of it back,
yeah,
either to a location in Fresno or perhaps back up at the lake. You know, they'll never get another piece out of the lake because the government finally passed a rule stating that any military equipment, either a ship or a plane, is still the government property and that's preserved in place without permission to move it. What happened in the other lake is that plane was the first one lost. It disappeared because it crashed into the face of a mountain. It went post-war, and the father of the co-pilot spent every summer, he was an outdoorsman type, he spent every summer up there looking for this plane. The plane was piloted by a guy named Turvey. But the only Californian aboard was Second Lieutenant Robert Hester. His father, as I said, spent the war and the post-war period looking for that plane, and he never found it. And a few years later, 1 year later, after he died, a survey crew was up there, and they found a piece of a bomber by this unnamed lake. And then they found another, looked down and found another piece in the water. And they went, ranger that was with him, dived into this icy cold water and went down and retrieved it. And it turned out to be a recognizable piece from the first bomber, from the 461st that had set off the search that caused the second bomber to crash.
And that's where the lake got its name.
And that's where the lake got its name because it was named not only for the co-pilot, but for the father who had searched for his son's plane for all those years and never found it.
And that story is told in your book.
And that story is in the book, yeah.
And the book also has more stories about Hammerfield, about Camp Pinedale, and about what was happening at the Fresno Fairgrounds there. And, you know, there are a lot of things that caught my eye just thumbing through the book. But what are the things that you're most satisfied with having brought out in this four-year project for you?
Yeah. Well, I think most satisfied with the fact that it not only identifies Hammerfield's role, which was very significant, because, as I was saying, in the latter stages of the war, the Air Force, by that time it was called the Army Air Force, they transferred all of their night fighter training to Hammer Field. Mm-hmm. And Hammer became the headquarters for the P-61 Black Widow, which was like no other plane in the sky. And it was used primarily to go up and intercept bombing raids. And it was equipped with radar, and Fresno became the place where these guys trained. Now, the Knights must have been really something around here in those later days of the war. In addition to that, I also am proud of the fact that I not only told the Hammer story, but also Camp Pinedale and the Fresno Fairgrounds. Now, when you mention them, those sites to people about the war years, most everybody seems to recall the internment camps that were there. But hardly anyone is aware that once the internment period, which only lasted about 4 months at each camp, those facilities were turned over to the Army Air Corps, and they became military facilities. Camp Pinedale became the Western Signal Aircraft Training Center for the western half of the United States. And they trained communications individuals in every phase of communication, radio, telephone lines, anything you can think of that had to do, including code breaking at Pinedale. Mm-hmm. And they trained as units out there pretty much. And they would march a unit out of there about every couple of weeks, it seemed like, at the end of the war, load them up on troop trains, way out there in Pinedale, where there was a lot of open ground.
Not anymore.
Not anymore, no. And there's not a trace of Pinedale left. Maybe a warehouse. Part of the Pinedale was a supply depot, and because they had the old warehouses from the cotton compress days, when the military bases shut down, Pinedale became the focal point. They gathered up everything loose from the fairgrounds or the Hammer, and moved them out to Pinedale until they were sold off or transferred around the country to other places. Now, the fairgrounds became a kind of a basic training camp. Troops that went in there received their basic training before they went off to other Air Force or Air Corps units. But both of them were active Army posts.
Fresno was a hopping place during World War II.
As a matter of fact, one of the figures that I use and has been used elsewhere, there were 60,000 troops in Fresno at the peak of the operations of those three camps.
Wow.
So there are a lot of GIs around town on Saturday night.
Oh, yeah, dancing at the Rainbow Ballroom, right?
Well, not only there, but in the Moose Hall and so on. There's a couple of pictures in there. We had the USO had facilities there, and the band from Hammerfield played there, and also KMJ had had a radio show put on by the GIs, and I have to say that KFRE, which was a big time operation in Fresno then, also had a GI show. It was a swinging place.
There are a few things I want to talk about with you. First, I want to thank you for writing this, because you've given Fresno a gift by recording this history and compiling it all in the form that we can actually thumb through and read it and not have to spend 4 years researching it like you did. You got your pictures for the book from Fresno Bee archives or military records?
Some of them are from the archives. Some of them are military. A couple from the Historical Society. You have to keep searching and searching. Unfortunately, a lot of the military pictures that were here at one time have disappeared or dissipated, let's say, over time. It's a little late to be getting involved in an event that far back. And most of the people who were involved are gone. Many are gone. Much of the material that they had, maybe they've been passed on from generation to generation. People have moved away and so on. Most of the military pictures are now back in the Air Force keeps their own archives.
And you mentioned that most of the people are gone. But one thing you did in putting this book together, besides just looking at old newspaper clippings and old photographs, is you interviewed some people who were in the service at that time. Some of them have been on this program. How helpful was that to you, and how much does that add to the book to have those first-person perspectives?
Oh, I think the first-person is very important because you can recite the dry military history, but each individual has got, even the ones that don't want to talk about it much, have got the facts in it. You have to sometimes double-check them, but or say, no, is that right, or did this happen this way? And, oh, yeah, that's right. So you have to pursue the facts and also look for it. And, of course, like Tom Brokaw has got three or four books out on it. And there's a group that meets out at the Clovis Memorial District on Mondays where they try to encourage guys to put their own stories, not only where a bunch of GIs get together, you know, you're going to have nothing but story after story, but to try to encourage those guys to put them down on paper.
And Janet Stevens has done that through that class with a couple of books.
Janet Stevens, exactly. Yeah. She's is the leading proponent of that, and also she played a role in connecting me up with the Clovis Memorial District, which published this book as a benefit, I might add, for the two military museums, that is the Legion of Valor Museum down in the auditorium in Fresno, and in the Clovis Museum, which has a military room. All of the proceeds from the sale of the book go to those two museums.
Right. You're not keeping anything from this book. The Clovis Veterans Memorial District and the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor in downtown Fresno, are benefiting from this book. That's super.
In fact, the copies of the book are available at both those sites as well as the Clovis Veterans Memorial District office.
Yeah, so go get one and take it with you Saturday to Chandler Airport so you can have them sign it and you can meet the man who has entertained and informed us these last 2 weeks. More from the book Into the Night with George Gruner when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K through 12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll bring it in for a landing now with 88-year-old George Gruner. His book is called Into the Night. If you want to explore some unique Central Valley history, this book is for you. And I've been telling you, you should go out and meet Mr. Gruner next Saturday, May the 4th at Chandler Airport. Tell me what's happening out there.
Well, as I understand it, there's going to be an observance, Chandler Field's history, as part of a general history observance.
Yeah, I guess it's called an Architectural History of Fresno's Aviation Heritage. I have a link on our website at kmjnow.com with more information. There will be some vintage planes out there, too, which will add to the experience, I'm sure. And I don't know if there's anywhere in Fresno that makes you feel like you're in a time machine back to the 30s or 40s as much as a trip to Chandler Field does.
Well, you know, Chandler is an interesting location because it's a 1930s airport. Mm-hmm. It's Fresno's. It was Fresno's airport.
Right.
And in fact, there was an effort made to make that the military airport.
Right.
The city went out and bought additional land and hoped to make it big enough for a bomber base. Well, it almost sneaked through. The local guys said, okay, we'll take that. But they sent the proposal back to Washington, and the engineers back there said, no, it's too close to town, too small, so on. And they were looking at another site out White's Bridge, about 10 miles out. Mm-hmm. So it could have been on the west side. It could have been at Chandler, but it ended up in an alfalfa and cotton field at, near Clovis Avenue and Shields.
Where most people fly out of Fresno today, what used to be Hammer
That's
Field.
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact, when the war ended and the city took it over, I'm sure that they must have had the thought in mind that that would be the principal airport from then on. Mm-hmm. Although the commercial flights were still going out of Chandler. But they reached a point where as the planes got bigger and more powerful, the runways just weren't big enough. So they said, well, we're not going to fly out of here. So then they said, well, come on, we'll switch out to Hammer Field, which by that time they decided to give it a new name.
Mm-hmm. Well, and speaking of names, and I don't want to give the whole book away here, but to give people a reason to read the book and give them a hint of some of the stuff in there, one of the things you have in there is an explanation of how it was named Hammer Field.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That was a big deal when they dedicated it.
Yeah.
Hap Arnold, the top general in the whole Air Force, was here in Fresno to dedicate it, right?
No, they were holding off dedication until they could get Hap Arnold
until
here.
Until he could come.
But they
okay.
never got him here.
See, and, I didn't read the whole story.
So yeah. They got his Hammer's mother to come down. And Hammer was a guy, a fellow from San Francisco.
Yeah, what's the story? How did it become Hammer Field?
Well, he was a pilot in World War One. He grew up in the Bay Area. He graduated from UC, and he went off to join the RAF, only the Royal Flying Corps, as it was called in those days. And he was flying little old biplane. It was not a Spad. Those were ours. But he was flying a de Havilland, I think it was, on a mission. And he was shot down. He was the first American flyer killed in World War One,
wow.
Really before we got in.
Uh-huh.
And so his name went on a list. And there was a list of names that were considered for the naming of the field. And the local officials, city officials, had picked another name. They submitted that to Washington, but Washington said, well, now, wait a minute. That fellow's not a Californian. He happened to be the son and grandson of a couple of Army generals. But he said, he's not a Californian. So here's the first Californian. This guy's already on the list to be honored with the name of Field. And so Earl Hammer is who the field is named for. And the interesting story is that the local Army flyers out there, they are part of the 40th Air Combat Brigade that fly helicopters, and they have their base at Clovis and Shields.
Right.
They've just been back from Middle East recently. They claim to be the successors to the folks who flew and Hammer as Army Air Corps types.
Uh-huh.
And so they have a monument to Earl Hammer in their front yard alongside their flagpole, and it says Hammer Field on it. So they claim that's still the name.
Sure, absolutely. Well, that's super. And you can read that whole story in Mr. Gruner's book, Into the Night, Hammer Field, Camp Pinedale, Fresno Fairgrounds, Central California in World War II. A couple of the other things that I noticed in your book, you've got some great photographs, and you know, you've been in Fresno and the Valley long enough to realize that when famous people come through here, people tend to get excited. I had an event with Tim Tebow recently, and it was, you know, it was quite the atmosphere. And you have in the book pictures of famous folks heading through Fresno to go to Hammer Field. Marlena Dietrich's in there, Tyrone Power.
Yeah.
Any other fun nuggets like that that maybe you weren't aware of until you started doing the research?
Well, of course, I didn't know about any of that, at least Marlena's connection. And that picture of Tyrone Power, now you see he wasn't assigned there, but somebody, he flew through Fresno. He was a pilot, and he flew through Fresno in a stormy situation, and he landed overnight. So he was out at Hammer. Somebody took his picture while he had a hamburger and a milkshake, and he was a Marine Corps officer, so he would, you know, you would not expect too many Marines to go through Hammer, but somebody took his picture. The public relations department there was on the ball now, and that picture turned up of all places, out at Kearney Park. Mm. From the Historical Society, and they had a clipping, a news item that they'd picked up somewhere and a picture they'd picked up somewhere. The thing about research is that facts are where you find them. They are all over the place, and I've had that true in each of the three books that I've written, that you never know when you're going to find something. In fact, there's a reference in there to the Enola Gay and Tibbetts.
Really?
Tibbetts flew through Fresno.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that out just in the latter stages of the book was almost in production. And I was at a dinner meeting with a group that I belonged to, and a fellow leaned over the table, and he says, "Hey, George, I just saw on the military channel that Paul Tibbetts,
yeah.
Right. Funny, you should know that name.
Yeah.
Paul Tibbetts flew a unit through Fresno." And I said, What? I said, "I didn't know that." And I had put in 4 years at that point, and I didn't know that Tibbetts was here. So I went to Fresno State. I got Paul Tibbetts' book written and ghosted with a couple of other guys.
Right.
And he talked about his brief encounter with Fresno. And I also got a hold of the hunk of film on the military channel where he talked briefly about Fresno. Just passing couple of sentences.
Sure.
But it made a chapter, and there's a snapshot in here in the book about Paul Tibbetts and Fresno.
Fresno had a big role in World War II. Is there anything else about your book that you want people to know? I think it's great that you are donating all the proceeds to those two wonderful organizations that do so much for history and for veterans here in the Valley. Anything else that we should know about it?
Well, I just think that, you know, that there's not just facts in the book, but the book is in the museums. But that museum downtown particularly is a very good military museum.
Sure is.
And a lot of people in town just don't recognize it, have never been there, and they really ought to go there, take their kids. And you can spend a couple hours there looking at not just write-ups, but artifacts from World War II.
And other wars.
And others.
The docents there are very knowledgeable. Many of them
served
in some of these wars.
That's right.
And the library, where your book is just an absolute fountain of terrific information. So that's great advice. And anyone that hasn't been there, it's right across from the old water tower in downtown Fresno, the Veterans Memorial Museum, home of the Legion of Valor, and it's open till 3:00. There was one more thing I was going to ask you. Well, if you've written these three books, and I think everyone listening today can tell that you still have a lot of energy, that you have some passion for this kind of thing. Have you thought about what your next project might be?
Well, I'm 88 years old, so I don't know that I could commit to a 4 or 5 year research project. But my wife and I, when I talked a while back about going to Europe and traveling, and what we did, we started by sailing out of Oakland to London on a freighter, and we were 47 days on a cargo liner. Actually, it was back in those days. This is 1952. Shipping lines still had cargo passenger service along the west coast to Europe, and we went on this freighter for 47 days, and I've got some pictures of that through the Panama Canal, all the way up to Rotterdam, and then back across the estuary, right up the Thames River, and got off at the Tower Bridge in London, and I thought I'd write an article on that for a magazine that deals with steamship history.
That sounds like a good idea.
I'm still trying to play golf a little bit now and then. All these other things keep me hopping.
I guess so. I guess the one more question I should ask you about your book, for all the people that read it, and hopefully young people will be just as interested in it as older people, and that they'll get a sense for this history that they probably had no idea about. Is there one thing that, with all that time you spent on it, that you really want people to get out of that book when they close that final page and put it back on the coffee table, that you want them to understand or feel?
Well, I think it would be an appreciation of history and the fact that there are certain things around town, like the swimming pool at Airways, that was built for Hammer Field.
Mm-hmm.
And the kids that go out there today are having the benefit of not only the fact that these guys went off and fought and died and for them, mm-hmm. but they left something behind, and that people should appreciate the history and remember those guys.
Perfect. Well said. Well, I want to thank you for serving our country and for giving us a lasting legacy here with this book and the others you've written. Is there anything else you want us to know?
No, probably not. No,
perfect.
I'm still trying to stay active, and I think it's good for older people to have projects, mm-hmm. whether it be making things. I live in San Joaquin Gardens with and I eat dinner every night with a gentleman, a service veteran, and he'll be 102.
Wow.
On November 11th. He was born 11-11-11. And maybe you ought to have him on.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he's active. He works in the wood shop every day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Sounds like somebody I'm going to have to track down before November. It's been a treat to have George Gruner on these last 2 weeks. Go shake his hand next week at Chandler Airport and join us again next Saturday for another edition of Hometown Heroes on KMJ.